Well, it looks like we've worked our way through the recession, and slowly but surely, the coronavirus pandemic is coming under control. That means that the recession that we had was very different from previous recessions, and in fact different from what most people had predicted. But what does this mean about the recovery? What is it going to be like? Remember earlier this year they talked about a V and a U and a W and a whoosh sort of recovery. That's what I'm going to talk about today with financial commentator Pete Wargent as we discuss what's ahead for our economy, why the recession panned out as it did, and how that's going to set the scene for the next stage of Australia's economy. And this is going to be particularly useful for property investors, for business owners and professionals, as well as just mums and dads who want to know what's ahead for them financially. And in today's mindset message, I'm going to discuss the concept that money can actually buy happiness. But before you get too excited about it, there are a couple of qualifications. So lots to talk about. Welcome to today's episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast.
Welcome to the Michael Yardney Podcast, where twice each week you will learn a number of new ideas regarding success, property investment and money in around 30 minutes. Our show is brought to you by Metropole, who specialise in helping you grow, protect and pass on your wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. Now here's your host, Michael Yardney, Australia's most trusted property commentator who has once again been voted Australia's leading property investment advisor. That's the fifth time he's won a similar award in the last 7 years.
Take your mind back to March this year when we started to realise that the coronavirus wasn't an illness that was just happening over there, you know, in that other country. It was a time when lockdown suddenly started to hit us. And there was much debate about what would be happening to our economy and to our property markets. Most economists predicted there'd be a recession. But there was a significant variation in their forecasts, how long it was going to be, how deep it would be, was it going to be a recession like in the past decades, or maybe it's going to be worse like the Great Depression. And what would the outcome be? Would it be a V, a U, a W, an L? Remember all those discussions, or even a swoosh? So today I want to discuss why this recession that we've just worked our way out of and the subsequent recovery that we're moving into is going to be different to past downturns. I'd like to discuss that with Pete Wargent. Now, you'd have to be living under a rock if you didn't know who Pete was, but if you're new to this podcast, Pete's a chartered accountant, a chartered secretary, and he's got a financial planning diploma. But using his long-term approach to building businesses and to investing in equities and owning a property portfolio, Pete achieved financial independence at the age of 33. Now, when I first started introducing Pete well over a decade ago, I used to call him one of the up-and-coming financial whiz kids. But Pete, you're no longer a whiz kid anymore. You've just had another birthday, haven't you? So you're no longer a kid.
Yeah, unfortunately got a four in front of the number these days. So I think on one of the TV shows, they said I was a veteran analyst. And I thought, yeah, I've gone from promising youngster to veteran in not a very long space of time. So,
well, that is a credit to you, though, because you have survived. And it's interesting that the perspective that you bring, partly from living half your life in Europe and half in Australia, from having various educational disciplines, academic disciplines, but also doing it and being on the ground and having some successes and some areas that haven't worked as well, that's actually given you a great perspective to be an analyst. So I'd be interested now to have a bit of a chat about what happened this time around, why this recession was different. And even though we're over it, I think there's still some interesting lessons, because while technically we may not be in recession according to the Reserve Bank, we won't know the official figures for a while, Pete, but similarly, it's not all over yet, is it?
No. So I think they do get a little bit bogged down in the technical definition. I suspect you'll see that in the most recent quarter, growth is now positive again, but, you know, it's still a long way back from where we've come from to get back to pre-COVID levels in the economy. So technically the recession might be over, but the rebound has still got a long way to run at this stage.
Well, let's have a talk about the recession first, and then we can have a talk about the rebound. Look, I understand why it was difficult for economists to make predictions. It was uncharted territory. We really didn't know what's going on. And that came from a lot of the academics and the economists and the banks. Of course, there was always the perpetual property pessimists, you know, those negative Nellies out there grabbing sensational headlines. Once again, they were proven wrong. They're still out there, Pete. They're saying we've just kicked the can down the road and we've still got difficult times ahead. What would you say to them?
Well, the discussion changes a lot. I mean, clearly, prices have stopped falling anyway, even in Melbourne now, which is reopened. But we've seen the Reserve Bank has essentially released or unleashed a bazooka this week at the time of recording. So that's further interest rate cuts, quantitative easing. We've seen massive cuts in fixed rate mortgages this week. So several of the banks are now doing fixed rates at under 2%. So you can pretty much forget price falls from this point. There are still the issue or issues relating to mortgage deferrals, but it does seem that the latest figures were out from NAB this week and Westpac and ANZ have reported. And so there's still some way to go to get people all back to repaying mortgages, but there's just more and more measures being taken to kick that particular can out until next year. And in fact, there's even a moratorium on foreclosures at CommBank. So I suspect that by the time the middle of next year rolls around, that issue will have gone away.
Well, firstly, as you say, many mortgage holders who deferred their mortgage, they still got to pay the mortgage interest. They just had a holiday for a while. Many are back to paying. Having said that, you can't imagine with everything that's gone on that in March or whenever it's going to be that the banks are now going to say, aha, we're going to foreclose. That's not what they want, is it?
No, I mean, in Australia, there's very little incentive for banks to do that anyway. But this time around, it's a very different recession. It was effectively mandated by the government shutdown. And the regulators are well aware of the potential issues. So they're working with the lenders. So we've already seen mortgage holidays extended out until next year. But even beyond that, so NAB reported today that they will offer restructuring or 12 months interest only options for stressed borrowers and potentially just an extension being offered on mortgage holidays. I just don't see anyone being forced into a foreclosure situation for a long period of time, by which stage the arrears will have normalized and we'll be back to some kind of normality.
And it'll be easier to pay the lower interest rates. Well, you said something a second ago, which leads into where we were going to talk about why this recession is different, because it was caused by a government-mandated shutdown, and it's changed the way we behaved. It had to do with this preventing the spread of coronavirus rather than the normal economic downturn due to bad economic fundamentals, Pete.
So this is really a health-driven recession. So normally recessions, they tend to be preceded by overinvestment or maybe, you know, a housing boom that's gone too far, or quite often in times gone past, excessive inflation, which leads central banks to have to hike interest rates and tighten. But this is the exact opposite, essentially. We weren't really in a boom period going into this crisis. It was a mandated shutdown, but the stimulus and response will be very different from what we've seen in previous recessions.
Well, the response was different, wasn't it? So all of a sudden, governments around the world, and in Australia in particular, had this massive upfront monetary and fiscal easing. And sure, some people said it kept businesses alive on life support, but it did. It helped businesses, jobs, incomes. More importantly, though, kept the flow of credit going. In previous recessions, and some people listening to this won't remember, there was the fright, the scare that you couldn't get money, you couldn't get credit. There was even a fright at times in previous recessions, you couldn't get money out of your Visa account, your credit card account out of the bank.
Yeah, and that's really what governments and regulators have learned, is that you need to keep the flow of credit moving. Essentially, it was much more preemptive this time around. We saw massive monetary easing all around the world, huge fiscal stimulus. So the government in Australia is running a massive deficit, which will take a number of years to normalize. So we've got interest rates now at record lows. We've got quantitative easing, which has effectively been normalized in a number of developed countries and now in Australia as well. So it's very, very different to all of the other recessions that have happened since World War II, where often there's a lag before there's a response. But this time it's all up front. So the governments and central banks have just got straight onto the front foot.
Well, some people would say, hey, that's not fair. You're supporting businesses, you're supporting property investors, you're not looking after me, the government's not doing its job. Pete, I think the government is doing its job. I think one of the government's job is to look after its citizens. It does that by providing hospitals and education and aged care, but we probably shouldn't even go down that route at the moment. But it's also to give us stability, and having the stability of your homes, having the wealth effect of having a castle, a security of knowing that your home isn't dropping in value. I believe that's also an important part of the government's role.
Yes. I mean, I guess there are two arguments. One is that a lot of small businesses have been unable to trade. So through no fault of their own, they've got into difficult situations. And therefore, a lot of people would quite justifiably say they need support. The other argument is that, I suppose, the way capitalism has worked in the past is that recessions and slowdowns and downturns, they tend to clear out unproductive businesses, which is tough in the short term, but then allows capital to be redeployed for the next boom. So potentially you could argue that you'll see more sort of zombie companies being kept alive. But on balance, I think that's not a bad thing. And the Reserve Bank has been very clear in what it said. It's a national priority to get back to full employment. So that is now the priority. And that means interest rates will be stuck at zero for at least 3 years, but quite possibly much longer than that.
Another reason this recession wasn't as bad as some people had initially thought or forecast was because of those debt holidays, the rent moratoriums, the relaxation in insolvency rules that you'd already mentioned. So what that's really done is given us the lifeline to get through. They're not using the word anymore, but way back, Scott Morrison said he's building a bridge across to the future. And now they're not going to pull the rug out from under us on this road. They're going to keep doing things. So the federal government has had a great budget. So far at the time of this recording, we haven't seen any state governments. It's their turn to chip in now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's actually it's a really unusual thing that's happened this year as well. You mentioned the government tipping in all the stimulus. Certainly, since the mining boom years, Australia has become a relatively wealthy country. And normally, we see more people actually leaving Australia than coming in on a short-term basis. So in other words, people, they take their holidays and they go overseas and spend money. This year, that's been impossible for a lot of Australians. So all of that extra money in the economy is circulating at home. So although we're missing the tourists, actually on a net basis, there's more Aussie dollars washing around. So we're seeing that in record retail sales, things like luxury car sales are booming now. So a lot of that money that would normally go overseas and be spent on holidays is actually circulating at home. So I guess once things normalize and get back to some kind of situation where the borders can reopen, then things can rebound pretty quickly.
Sure. Another thing that this recession did was, I think, bring forward some structural changes, particularly in the area of technology, working from home, online retailing, digital meetings. And it's not all negative, is it?
No, I think some of that will stick as well. Whenever you get these situations of people moving from cities, there's always sort of predictions of the death of cities and so on. That's been going on for decades, but it never really happens. But I think once the pandemic passes, we'll probably see some of those trends sticking. So maybe more virtual meetings and more working from home. But the thing is, the tech sector is becoming more important. But if you look at where all of the major tech players are situating, take Australia as an example, Google, Facebook, Amazon, Tesla, Apple, they're all in the heart of Sydney CBD or within a K or two of the CBD. So clearly the CBDs are still going to be important. It's just that people might not be in the office 5 days a week.
Sure. So I guess if we went back 50 years or 100 years when we were more a manufacturing country or living off the land, it would have been very different. So some jobs can't be done from home or remotely or even in different countries, but Australia's become a knowledge country. We've actually stepped up, and I guess the timing was right for that. It's working. So what's ahead now? We've seen an initial sharp rebound as businesses are opening, people are returning to work. There's been a pent-up demand. And I'm not just talking about property. Let's just talk about the economy first, and then we can talk about property. After that rebound, is this the beginning of a V-shape, or do you see a more stepwise, slower, bumpy recovery moving forward?
Yeah, I think a V-shape recovery is probably optimistic. I think we had a setback, as you experienced in Victoria, but also with the borders still effectively remaining shut to international students and tourists and permanent migrants. I don't think we'll just see things rebound to where they were. But in saying that, Australia is much better placed than most countries around the world. I mean, in recent days, we don't want to jinx it, but effectively eliminating the virus. And Australia, I know we like to complain about stuff, but if you look at it in global terms, it really has emerged alongside New Zealand as probably the best place on earth to be. So when the borders do reopen, the demand from people from Hong Kong or elsewhere in Asia, it's going to be huge for living in Australia. So I think the rebound next year can be pretty strong.
Having said that, we're not isolated, and so therefore the global economy is going to affect us as well. And I think with what's happening overseas with regard to second waves and third waves, the global economy, global GDP is going to suffer a little bit, and that means we're going to suffer a little bit more too moving forward.
Yeah, I think you're right. Europe is, it was always going to happen going into winter, they get a second wave, but it does look to be quite severe just in terms of its sheer scope. So I don't think the global economy will be rebounding as sharply as had been hoped, and the virus will be around for some time to come. But obviously the hopes of a vaccine continue. And even as we speak, I think further monetary easing being issued, Bank of England's brought forward its next meeting. So I suspect we'll see globally zero interest rates in a lot of countries for a number of years to come now.
We've spoken about interest rates a few times, and you've also mentioned quantitative easing. Now, while I understand it, and it's a word that's bandied around a bit, maybe you could just explain to people who don't fully understand what that means and what that's going to mean as a borrower for your home loan or for your property investment.
Yeah, so, well, there's two things that the Reserve Bank has stated that it wants to see. One is it's trying to lower borrowing costs around the economy. So there's a number of ways that they do that. Firstly, the cash rate, which is what everybody reports on each month when the Reserve Bank meets. But this year, we've got something a bit different. So there's a target for the three-year government bond. So without getting too technical, that's an important funding benchmark in Australia. So it's important for mortgages and therefore for mum and dads, the rate at which they can borrow. But the Reserve Bank is now likely to go further with QE, so also reducing interest rates on longer-dated bonds to try and encourage further borrowing across business as well. The other thing that the RBA would probably like to see is the Aussie dollar falling from where it is, because that just helps to stimulate the domestic economy. So that's essentially what it is. People call it all kinds of things, money printing or whatever, but it's essentially asset purchases to reduce interest rates.
So that means not just the home loan rate or the property investment rate, but you talk about credit cards, business loans, and more related to 3 and even longer term loan rates. It's also giving the banks cheaper overnight money, which means that, well, they basically said it, interest rates are not going to go up for at least 3 years. And that gives people a level of security. One of the things that concerned investors was the bogeyman of a sudden rise in interest rates. That's nowhere near ahead of us, is there?
No, I mean, I've seen a few media pieces that say, who on earth would make a decision based on an extra 15 basis points of interest rate cuts? But that's a bit sort of facetious to make that comment, because the reality is home buyers and investors, they make decisions based on the trend. And as you said, for a number of years, there was just endless articles about, oh, when interest rates go up, then you know, everybody's going to be stressed and blah, blah, blah. But not only has that not happened, we're actually seeing the trend. Interest rates are now falling, and fixed rates are continuing to fall to record lows. So I think that in itself will encourage more people, especially in housing. It will be a housing-led recovery. I think a lot of people have sort of weighed up that buy versus rent equation, and now it's actually cheaper to buy than it is to rent. So that has always historically driven more people into especially the capital city housing markets.
Sure. So let's finish off with, what does all this mean for the property markets? What are your thoughts about what's ahead for the last little bit of 2020 and moving forward for the next couple of years?
Well, we do quite a bit of work with Riskwise Property Research, and they've got their quarterly report coming out. And I suspect what you will see is forecasts of double-digit housing price growth next year. Not everywhere. Sydney and Melbourne will lead the way. Strong performance for Brisbane as well. But there are just some sectors of the market that will lag. So at the moment, that's those high-rise apartments in the CBD. No international students around at the moment, much less in the way of international tourism. So there's still a lot of vacant apartments to be taken up. So it won't really be seen everywhere, but I think nationally you'll see strong price growth for housing next year, just driven purely by all of that pent-up demand from this year, and now even further falls in the borrowing rate.
As well as increased stimulus from, we know, the federal government, and we assume the state governments are going to do that, and the increase in confidence. I mean, confidence is one of the big factors. It takes into account people's level of financial security and what they think is going to happen. So all that's going to fall into place nicely. Interestingly, a year ago you wrote a new book, which I know was held up a little bit related to COVID, and you were wondering, would it come out? I know it has now, Low Rates, High Returns. You were talking about a period of low interest rates and how to work your investments better this way. What was that one about? What was that book about?
It was mainly a stock market focused book. I think we get a lot of property investors doing our coaching programs who they've already fully got exposure to the property market, and they're looking for other ways to generate income and grow their wealth. We get a lot of people read the book who have come from that particular cohort. But it was really about how to generate consistent investment returns in an era of low interest rates. And I co-authored it with my friend Stephen Moriarty. And we joked when we chose the title, let's hope that interest rates don't go up now we've chosen this title. But actually, as it transpired, they've just kept falling. So I think what we expected, which is essentially a decade of very low interest rates, is going to play out now.
Well, we'll have a link to the book in the show notes, but you've also got a podcast with the same name, which I regularly listen to, so I'll put a link to that as well. Now, you're in England at the moment and Steve's in Australia still, so you're going to be locked down for a little while and have a bit of difficulty coming back. What's the sentiment happening across in Europe at the moment?
Yeah, it's different for Europe. So I think a lot of frustration. A lot of countries are going into lockdowns for a month so that people can mix over Christmas. Christmas in Europe tends to be a really big family occasion. I know it is in Australia, but even more so in the European winters. So 4 weeks of lockdown for Great Britain, albeit not quite as tough as the first time around. But yeah, sentiment's pretty rough. Strangely, the housing market has done really well because stamp duty has been, well, essentially exempt under 500K. So the housing market has actually gone up quite sharply. But generally in the economy, things aren't good, a lot of job losses. And I think people have just had enough, to be honest.
Yes, having come out of it in Melbourne, I know how you feel. So I guess to finish off, Australia is the lucky country. We've known that, we've said that, but it's been shown again it's performed much better than other comparable countries in controlling the coronavirus. It's seen a strong economic policy response. And looks like we've gotten over the worst of it, and the best is yet to come. So I look forward to having a chat with you again real soon, Pete. Hope you get through this lockdown period.
Pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
In a moment, I'm going to share my mindset message with you. I'm going to talk to you about, does money really buy happiness, and give you the results of some studies. The results, in fact, may surprise you. But before we discuss that, I'd like to just follow up on a comment that Pete made. He was suggesting that the RiskWise report may well be showing us that we're going to end up with double-digit capital growth in some of our capital cities moving forward. I'm not sure I agree with that. Metropole's research is a little bit more conservative than that. It also shows that some segments of our property market are still going to languish and fall flat, and Pete mentioned that, while others are going to outperform. But hey, that's the way it's always been. If you want to dig into our research and understand why we believe certain neighbourhoods, certain locations, certain types of properties will perform well over the next decade, why not have a chat with my team at Metropole? I think to secure your financial future in this current challenging environment, you're going to need much more than just a property strategist. You're going to need much more than the buyer's agent. At Metropole, we offer a 360-degree holistic approach to ensure you grow, protect, and pass on your wealth to future generations. We're going to customize a solution for you. We don't have any properties for sale. We help beginning investors get into the market, experienced investors build their portfolio, and sophisticated investors manufacture capital growth by becoming property developers. We do medium density property development on their behalf. So go to metropole.com.au, find out about our full range of services. You can use some, you can use all. We'd love to be part of your wealth creation journey. metropole.com.au.
Now here's Michael's mindset message. Remember, a change in your thinking will lead to a change in your life.
In today's mindset message, I'd like to have a chat with you about the age-old debate. Does money really buy happiness? And there's interestingly a lot of scientific work giving suggestions on both sides of the argument. I'd like to give you six reasons today why money can buy you happiness. Now, again, it's not for everybody, and we know that some people with some interesting, unpleasant behaviours become even more unpleasant when they get more money. But generally speaking, having enough money for the basic necessities in life, as well as your wants and needs, usually means a happier life. Now, I'm not saying money's going to solve all your problems. Clearly it's not. Money's important in those areas of your life where it's important, and it's not at all important in other areas of your life where it's not important. But any problem money can solve isn't really a problem when you have money. While there's plenty of research out there, as I said, that money does indeed buy happiness, the secret is it seems that true happiness comes from deep personal connections and life experiences rather than material goods. And boy, have we seen this in some of the challenging times brought upon us over the last while with COVID-19. But there's also information showing that people at the lower end of the income scale are more vulnerable to depression and other mental health problems. Now, again, this is not a judge of people, but let's just have a look at some of the research indicating that money does indeed play a role in making people happier. First of all, it's been shown your children's brains are going to benefit. There's a growing body of evidence supporting the idea that growing up in poverty can have a long-term impact on children's cognitive development. In the most extreme cases, children who've endured something called toxic stress are shown to actually have chemically altered their brains and don't perform as well. The second reason money can buy happiness is you're less likely to experience depression. A 2012 report revealed that people in poverty are more likely to suffer from health problems, with depression being the most common. About 31% of poor people said they'd been diagnosed with depression at some point in their life, compared to about 16%, half as many of those not in poverty. The third reason that money can make you more happy is it will allow you to save a life more. When you've got money, you don't need to focus so much attention on acquiring it in order to meet your basic needs. This frees up your mind to actually enjoy the experiences of life. There's been lots of studies suggesting that. Also, birds of a feather flock together, so many happy people associate with other happy people, making your life even better. The fourth reason is that money can buy you valuable experiences. There's considerable evidence that buying stuff doesn't really make anyone happier. Well, it does in the short term, doesn't it? But not in the long term. But paying for experiences, that gives you a really good bang for your buck when it comes to happiness, according to multiple studies. Now, whether it's swimming with the dolphins off the coast of Western Australia or hang gliding on the Sunshine Coast or whatever, experiences do cost money. Good experiences can, and having more money allows you to enjoy those. Now, the fifth reason why money can buy you happiness is you can spend money on others. When you've barely got enough to support yourself, you're probably not thinking about giving back to others. But being generous with your money is a path to happiness. It's something that we personally do, give a lot to charity, and you probably know that we've run a number of charity balls, and my wife Pam's run 3 charity balls recently, as well as donating time, effort, and money into a number of good charities. And the sixth last reason that money can make you happier is, interestingly, according to the Journal of Consumer Psychology, you're less likely to be lonely. They found people with meaningful social connections are generally happiest. And there's also evidence that people with less money are less likely to be lonely. There's been a number of reports showing that poor social networks made you more likely to be unhappy, and having money gave you a better access to a larger range of social networks. So again, money's not the most important thing in life. You can't really be truly wealthy unless you've got your health and unless you've got somebody to enjoy your life with and you can contribute back to the community and you can enjoy your time. But having said that, there's nothing wrong with the pursuit of money, A, to make you happier, and B, to give to others to make them happier, whether it's your family, your friends, or charity. In fact, I believe it's your responsibility when you're successful and wealthy to help others up the ladder as well. So hopefully in today's mindset message, you're now going to be more comfortable accepting the fact that money can buy you happiness. As we're coming close to the end of another podcast, I'd like to say thank you for taking the time to listen, and I hope you got some insights. You're going to have a bit more clarity and direction after hearing my chat with Pete Wharton. And if you got some benefit, it'd be great if you helped other people who also would benefit from the show by letting them know. Tell them about the podcast, use the share button on your podcast app, or leave us a review, as V. Sharmack did on Apple Podcasts recently. And if I read out your review, I'd be happy to say thank you by gifting you one of my books. So V. Sharmack, just email me, michael@metropole.com.au, and you wrote, "Educational and practical. I've been listening to this podcast for a year now, and I've already made some big steps in property, and I can already see a great improvement in my net worth. It's also improved my confidence, my health, my mental health as well. Thanks, Michael, for sharing your ideas and the message through this." Well, gee, V. Sharmack, I really appreciate you saying that, because that makes me feel really good that my message is getting across and helping people. Now, if you want to catch up with me between these twice-a-week podcasts, just look out for me on social media. Look for Michael Yardney. And my daily property update newsletter gives you not just my thoughts, but that of a whole range of property, tax, finance, money experts. I'll be back again real soon. In the meantime, have a great week. Make it a great week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Michael Yardney Podcast, which was brought to you by Metropole, who help their clients grow, protect, and pass on their wealth through strategic property and wealth advice. If you like what you heard and don't already subscribe, you'll find us on iTunes or on your favorite Android app as the Michael Yardney Podcast. Watch out for our next show, which comes to you twice a week, and you'll learn some new ideas about property investment, success, and money in around 30 minutes. To get more of Michael's thoughts, go across to www.propertyupdate.com.au and sign up for his daily morning briefing, and you'll hear from not only Michael, but a group of leading property success and money experts.
And just a reminder that the information you heard in this show today is general educational advice and not specific investment advice, as we don't know your personal circumstances. If you're looking for specific advice, why not ask the team at Metropole to help you?